Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We are happy to be back after a week on pause, and there's really a lot to get to. Open enrollment is underway for Californians who buy health insurance through Covered California. The state health insurance marketplace is reporting record low prices this year, but that's not the only headline. Covered California's first and only architect is stepping down after a decade of trailblazing health care reform across the state. Executive Director Peter Lee joins us now to explain what's new this year and also what's next for him as he gets ready to step down. Welcome, Peter, to Insight.
Vicky, great to be with you.
You were appointed by the state following the passage of the Affordable Care Act back in 2010. I mean, a healthcare marketplace of this nature obviously did not exist. Can you just share a little bit about your background and what made you the right fit for this role in overhauling healthcare reform across California?
Well, I've been involved in healthcare for most of my personal and professional life, really getting deep into health policy as an advocate around AIDS and HIV issues in the 80s when the AIDS epidemic was hitting the nation hard. So I started as a consumer advocate. I then actually went back to law school and came out of that to work in the Center for Healthcare Rights, a consumer advocacy group. From there, I worked with the Pacific Business Group, helping large purchasers try to buy better. That was followed by a brief stint with the Obama administration, supporting that administration implement changes to get better value for healthcare. I will tell you, after 2 years in DC, it was a nice call to get to recruit me to come join what became Cover California. I both missed California, which I think is a national leader, and the marketplace we established really was an opportunity to take my background as a consumer advocate, representing large employers, doing national policy work, to bear for Californians by actually setting a marketplace that is really about consumers and patients first. And in many ways, I think we've been really successful at that in the last 10 years.
Well, California is the largest state-based marketplace in the country. The uninsured rate in the state has dropped roughly like 10% since 2013 to about 7.7%. But I mean, that road to scaling up is far from smooth or predictable. I guess, what are the biggest obstacles that you're proud of overcoming in this time?
Well, the biggest one, and this is, and I will note, Vicky, not to correct you, but a little bit of good news is the 7.7% uninsured rate is from 2 years ago, from 2020. The California Interview Survey was released 2 months ago, which says we're now down to 6% uninsured rate.
Oh, great.
I just want to note that is that we have had in California the biggest drop of the uninsured in the entire nation. A part of that is Covered California, but a big part is our expansion of the Medicaid program. But while we aren't at universal coverage, we are a lot closer than we were 10 years ago. So that said, some of the challenges. The biggest one was this was a very big thing to implement quickly. And when I joined, we had no staff. We had to be ready to enroll people starting in October of 2013 for coverage that started in January of 2014 with nothing to start from. We had to contract with health plans. We had to share with them that we were going to be looking over their shoulder about quality. We need to develop big IT systems, develop a marketing program. All of those things took a real sprint out of the gate. And we did well. We enrolled a lot of people out of the gate. The next big challenge we had, though, was sadly what one might call the Trump years, where we had 4 years in which the federal administration, I mean, remember, Donald Trump ran on a platform of repealing and replacing the ACA. You know, that was a challenging time nationally, but in California, since we were a state-based marketplace, we don't rely on federal funds at all. We don't rely on state funds. We rely on a small assessment on our health plans. We actually grew during those 4 years when Trump was in office, and the state was able to implement a whole range of policies to hold federal policies at bay. So those are the two big challenges that we've done as a state pretty well in addressing.
Right. I think it's important to remind people that I think 35 states actually rely on the federal government for marketing and enrollment. And California is relatively unique in that it can stand alone and potentially and fared better during times when there's been a push to defund or even dismantle a government run healthcare marketplace.
Well, Vicky, if I could, just to put that in broad strokes, is during the era when Trump was in office, they stopped spending money on marketing. What did that mean? Fewer people signed up in the federal states that they were responsible for overseeing. We instead spend $100 million a year. And people might say, God, why spend money to help people get what for them is often free coverage? You need to tell people. And by us reaching out and telling people and supporting navigators and groups anchored to the diversity of our state, we have had more people sign up, which means not only do we reduce the rate of the uninsured, but healthcare costs go down because you get more people signed up who are on average healthier. It's a win-win. And it was really bad policy of the Trump administration, which led to across the nation, many, many people being priced out of coverage. We're in California, even those without subsidies have the opportunity to afford health insurance.
Well, important piece of this are insurers. How has the relationship with insurers evolved over the past decade?
Well, it's been an interesting relationship. It's, you know, on some levels, we are a tough taskmaster. We think we, as a marketplace, we're one of the only marketplaces in the nation that takes a very active role. We have turned health plans away. We have a raft of contractual provisions that say, what are you as a health plan doing, not just to get someone enrolled, but provide good quality services to the diversity of our state? What are you doing about health equity? What are you doing about behavioral health and mental health services? So in the end, though, because we have been upfront, a hard negotiate and push them, we've also made sure they don't lose a lot of money. Around the nation, some big health plans literally lost billions of dollars because they didn't know what they were doing. When we sit down with our health plans, we say, hey, here's what we're going to do on marketing. Here's who you should enroll. We don't want you to make much money, but if you lose money, you're going to come back next year and raise premiums a lot. We have had remarkably consistent premium increases. We've had health plans that have made a little profit, but it's a little profit. And they want to participate with us because they know what they get when they work with Covered California is a fair deal, but a deal that's anchored in being fair first for consumers. Mm-hmm.
You're going to be leaving Covered California after this open enrollment. What was behind that decision?
Well, you know, I've done this for 10 years, and it's been a great both privilege and opportunity to serve the state and in many ways be a national model for putting consumers first, for looking at health equity, for helping costs work. But the challenges we have with healthcare in America aren't just coverage challenges. Covered California is addressing a lot of the bigger issues as we speak, looking at health quality, looking at diversity, disparities. But some of the challenges we have need to be addressed more broadly. We have many people with employer-based coverage that really can't afford their health care. We have to address that, and I'm looking forward to new opportunities. And also, I think it's actually healthy for any organization to have new leadership. Someone walking into this role with their own shoes, their own background, their own perspective that I'm sure will reflect the passion that this board of directors has and that our organization has for being consumer-centric, but also driving change in the healthcare system as a whole.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Covered California's Executive Director, Peter Lee, about open enrollment to the state healthcare marketplace. So, there are record low prices this year. Why?
Yeah, it's really, really good and important question. So I want to remind folks, they may not have noticed this, but 2020, before the COVID pandemic hit, the state of California, under Governor Newsom's leadership, the legislature stepped up and said, we're going to provide state subsidies on top of the federal subsidies. And we're going to implement a penalty. If you don't have insurance and you can afford it, you should pay a penalty because we all pay the bills when you end up in a hospital and can't afford it. So those were big policies. We had big enrollment. But since then, with the Biden administration, they said, in the context of the COVID pandemic and the recession, we're going to actually provide bigger subsidies and change the rules of the game of the Affordable Care Act across the nation. So for lower income Californians that are eligible for coverage through Covered California, about over 50% are paying less than $10 a month for really good coverage now because the subsidies are bigger. But in addition, these new subsidies say, if you're a middle income Californian, that prior to this change, if you were a family of four that made $100,000, no matter how much you spent on healthcare, you wouldn't be eligible for financial help. That's changed. There's no longer what we call a cliff. anyone that does not have employer-based coverage should get a leg up to make healthcare affordable. And I just need to remind Vicky, you and your listeners, is that, you know, people say, well, why are we giving some people a leg up? Everyone that has employer-based coverage, which is about half of Californians, are getting financial help through a federal tax system that lowers that healthcare cost to them and their employer. What we're doing through Cover California is giving a leg up to everyone else. Everyone needs a leg up, unless you're Elon Musk, and we know he's going to get his billions when he sells his stock. But if you're not Elon Musk and you live in America, you need a leg up. That's what we're doing for people that don't have employer-based coverage.
Well, the pandemic, as we just continue to come to learn, just exacerbated existing inequities and challenges throughout the state. When it comes to covering California, how did the marketplace fare during the pandemic? Because it really is a go-to for people in the gig economy or even service workers who don't get coverage through their employer.
Yeah, well, the good bad news is Cover California's done, you know, one of the best jobs in the nation in terms of a good mix of carriers, good enrollment. We do good outreach. We were ready, sadly, for the pandemic. What we did in 2020 was we went to our board and said, in a recession is the time we should do more outreach. We got an approval to spend $40 million more. And what we've seen is big growth of enrollment. Sadly, that's because people losing employer-based coverage. And what we also saw is in this economy, we haven't seen a lot of people leaving us to go get employer-based coverage because there's less jobs available. So we saw growth in enrollment, but enrollment sounds abstract. What we saw was hundreds of thousands of Californians who lost their job getting coverage through us that they could afford. And just earlier last week when we launched open enrollment, we had a woman, Jingjing Kai, who had a family of three. Her adoption business went under because of the recession. She got coverage through Cover California for $3 a month for her entire family. I mean, and we saw literally hundreds of thousands of people that covered California was a safety net for and an avenue for many to get enrolled in the Medi-Cal program that we help people enroll in if they're not eligible for us because their income's too low. So, you know, we stepped up during the recession, during COVID, but we also are stepping up. And Vicky, I appreciate your point about spotlighting health equity. The pandemic put a spotlight on the fact that who got hurt most, both as a health issue as an economic issue, Latinos, African-Americans, communities of color. Covered California has, since the day we launched, has part of our mission statement to address healthcare disparities and health equity. It's something we've had a spotlight on since day one, but it's a healthy thing that the rest of the state does now. So when we push our health plans to saying, what are you doing? Not just to get people enrolled, but make sure people get the right care at the right time. You're providing different programs targeted African-Americans. You're culturally sensitive, reaching the Latino community. You've got networks of doctors and hospitals that meet all of their needs. That's the right thing that sadly the COVID pandemic put a spotlight on.
We were talking about an expansion in healthcare under the Affordable Care Act, but it's really been incremental over the past decade through Covered California and Medi-Cal, as you've been talking about. Do you think the state, California, is close to having universal health care? And if so, what would that look like?
Well, again, there's universal. The first thing universal means is everyone. I want us to start that the everyone. How you get there, there's a lot of paths to. We now have 6% of Californians uninsured. That's, again, the most recent data point. Of those, more than half are undocumented. And as you know, and listeners should know, is the state legislature and Governor Newsom have said, let's expand the Medi-Cal program for some of the undocumented. Why? COVID has brought home the fact that you cannot have a healthy community and say, my next door neighbor who's undocumented can get sick and I won't care because they have something different in their wallet, when they're part of the economic and health fabric of the community. So one of the key things we need to do as a state and a nation is address coverage of undocumented. Right now, undocumented residents of California cannot get coverage through Cover California by federal law. So that's one piece. How to structure universal coverage? Is it through the current patchwork of employer coverage, and then what I like to call the three M's, which is Medicaid, marketplaces, and Medicare. Those could be pieced together to get probably very close to what Europe has of 99% people covered. We're approaching that. We need to make sure the subsidies that are expanded under the American Rescue Plan are made permanent. They are addressed in the Build Back Better plan, which is still in discussion right now in Congress. And we need to make sure it's not just universal coverage, but that those that have coverage get good coverage. So again, I noted earlier, too many lower income workers who have employer-based coverage are not able to afford to get the access to care. So that's some of the things I've looked for down the road is universal true coverage that matters for Californians and Americans.
Well, before we let you go, in the last 30 seconds or so we have, I was going back to an interview that you did about 9 years ago, and you said that you wanted, when it came to Covered California, you wanted to roll up your sleeves in California because healthcare was being used as a political football, and you're diving in to do the work on reform. In the 9 or 10 years since, do you feel that you've chipped away at that, or do you still feel like it's being used as a political football?
Well, I will say, man, I look at my sleeves are rolled up right now. So I haven't changed on that front. And California is not immune to the divisiveness of politics in America. At the same time, in this state, we have done outreach and enrollment events with elected Republican, elected Democrats. We have made Covered California a part of every community of this state. When you drive through, whether it's, Bakersfield, or East LA, you'll see a storefront that says Covered California. So I actually feel really proud that we've made what we're doing nonpartisan. And the other things that we've done, wherever you fall on the political spectrum, many of the core foundational elements of the Affordable Care Act are now accepted no matter what party you're in. Can you turn someone away for coverage because they previously had diabetes? No. Do Americans need financial help if they don't have employer-based coverage? Yes, let's get that to them. So in many ways, I think that we've done a lot in California to show let's make the Affordable Care Act work for Californians and pull it out of the political maelstrom. So I think we've actually been relatively effective at doing just that.
Peter, thanks for spending time with us.
Vicki, great to be with you. I want to remind everyone, though, coveredca.com. 70% of the people signing up can get coverage for less than $10. If you're not insured, check it out.
Peter Lee is the executive director for Covered California and will be stepping down from the state-run healthcare marketplace at the end of this open enrollment period following a decade of leading and shaping Covered California. Up next, new redistricting maps are starting to take shape. We'll explore the potential changes to elections across California. Also, the state auditor is retiring after more than 2 decades. We'll take a look back at her legacy, and we'll also look ahead as the independent watchdog agency awaits a successor. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, midterm elections are right around the corner, and congressional and legislative districts will look different this time around. New redistricting maps are starting to take shape. It's a process done every decade following the census to make sure districts reflect the current makeup of the electorate. Making things particularly interesting this time around, California is losing one congressional district due to its population count. An independent commission has been refining district maps, which includes fielding a wide array of community feedback, and is expected to release first drafts later this week with a final deadline of December 27th. But we're already starting to get a look at possible scenarios. Joining us now is Paul Mitchell, who heads Redistricting Partners, which has conducted the redistricting of more than 35 cities, school boards, and community college districts. Paul, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Paul, there's some significant preliminary changes in Northern California. And, you know, input is still shaping these final district lines. But just given your wheelhouse, what reaction and input are you hearing?
Well, first off, the process they're using right now is a process of starting with doing visualizations, which we're oftentimes commissioners saying, well, what if we put this city and this city together? What if we put Placer and Sacramento together? And trying to get a sense of what things might look like. And we kind of jokingly refer to it as redistricting by Roomba, you know, just kind of going around and bouncing into walls and figuring out where they could go. But right now we're heading into a week where the Roomba is running out of batteries. And at some point they're going to end up with a draft map that comes out. And I think that there will be things that are really interesting to people when they get a first real look at what might be shaping the new districts. There are big demographic and population changes in the state. Sacramento County grew by over 15%, but then LA County grew by only 2%. And so you have these differences in population growth that really will shape. And then demographically, we grew in our number of Black and Latino and Asian residents in California, particularly Latinos statewide, and particularly Asians in very heavily Asian populations. But we lost 5% of our white population. And so one of the more vexing challenges for commissioners is to draw maps that are equally balanced and equitable so that we're not diluting the voting power of that growing minority population as we have to make all these shifts to make the districts all fit again.
Right. I mean, making sure diverse voices, that they actually have a voice, is paramount. Are these preliminary visualizations living up to that?
Well, the first visualization they put out solved the problem of elimination of one congressional district, because we lose a congressional district. And the way they drew their first visualization was to take that district out of one of the two Black community of interest districts in Los Angeles. So it did not meet the test at the first pass. Right now, they're still moving populations around. And I think there are challenges. These visualizations, you would think that every visualization gets better, but in the congressional maps, I think most of the groups that are looking at it look at the third visualization, the most recent one, and say, wait, we lost a Latino seat in Orange County. We lost Asian representation in the San Gabriel Valley. We potentially lost good districts in the Central Valley for Latinos. So the where the commission starts might be the biggest, most important process or part of the process going into, you know, maybe Wednesday when they get around to congressionals. So that's going to be a real big challenge, is figuring out how to get this ball rolling and how to make sure that they're starting with one of these visualizations that is most equitable to begin with.
Right. And, you know, these visualization maps as they currently stand, but obviously can change. I mean, there are some interesting or even some kind of pushback or sounding the alarm on some of these possible scenarios, you know, San Joaquin County being split into districts, even in Yolo County, Davis and Clarksburg joining like the far northern district, which encompasses Redding and Chico. I guess, what do these preliminary scenarios tell you about shifts in California's demographics?
Well, it's interesting because they're trying to balance the shifts in population and adjust for that puzzle at the same time as they're trying to adjust for shifts in demographics. It's it's almost like one of those brain teasers in the back of a New York Times Sunday section, where you're trying to play this multidimensional game where every time you think, okay, well, I can get more population here, you realize that you're hurting a community of interest or splitting a city or reducing the voting power of a minority group over there. And so when we look at individual maps, you're right, like Davis in one of the first maps was all the way to the Oregon border in that kind of state of Jefferson. In the third visualization, there's this arm coming out of Contra Costa County up through the Delta, and it just reaches out and literally just grabs Davis and takes it far, far south. So you see these things depending on your lens, where you might look just like, where's Davis today? And it's like you're getting hit upside the head by these different visualizations. But then when you step back and you look at how are these maps representing regions, how are they, as you mentioned, splitting up San Joaquin County or splitting up Sacramento County? Those are big issues that this commission has to deal with. And there's a lot of competing voices that they're listening to. And that is one last thing I want to mention, is that this is a vexing problem. It's a challenge, but it's in the right hands. It's in the hands of people who aren't the politicians trying to draw the lines for themselves. They aren't giving, you know, the most partisan line drawers and experts, you know, a box of cigars in a back room to draw lines. It is being done in an open, public, transparent process, and the people doing it, both on the staff and the commission, should be celebrated for their work, but we still also need to make sure that they're listening to the community voices and that people are showing up.
Well, talking about that independent role, that makes California relatively unique, because this is taking place across the country.
Yeah, California is the gold standard. You know, we're doing the redistricting also for the state of New York. We're working for the redistricting commission in New York, but it's not a truly independent commission like California's. We're advising a commission in New Mexico. We've worked with the commission in Alaska, and we're working in a bunch of different states that are doing these. And really, there's nothing better than the California model. And there are some local governments. We're working Long Beach that are using kind of a California model with independent commissioners and independent staff. But really, we have a long way to go in redistricting reform. And these half measures that we've seen in some instances really are just kind of cover for politicians to continue to draw their own lines. So this California model, we really, I think, as Californians and as Americans, deserve to have this in all of our redistricting. All states, major local governments should have a process like this that allows for residents to be involved in shaping districts, so that those districts do reflect the community, not reflect political parties or incumbents.
Well, we're seeing these maps or these visualizations continue to take shape and to be obviously shaped by input, by a variety of interests. We're going to get those first drafts sometime this week. There's a November 15th deadline, but the final deadline is December 27th. So we're really talking like 6 weeks. How much can change between November 15th and December 27th?
Well, a lot can change. In the last redistricting, we saw that from the first draft to the final, there were some parts of the state where there were significant changes made. And even the commissioners, as they're going through these visualizations yesterday, they were getting to the end of their meeting and they started talking about having bucket list thoughts. So they would say, well, I want to make this one change to put Colma back into this district or the other district. But then I have a bucket list. I want to make sure that when we draft these lines and get them actually finalized, that we fix this other big issue over here. And so commissioners in developing these drafts are already saying, here's our list of things we're not happy about in these drafts that we want to try to address. And some of those might be really big structural things. I think most people hope they'll figure out the structural things now and then worry about the little tinkering later. But if they can't get all the stuff done in the Assembly, Senate, and congressional plans by the time they have to pass these draft maps, I think we'll get a lot of signaling from the commissioners of, you know, here's the parts we're not happy with. We want community input, and we want to figure out a way to kind of resolve those issues before the final. And like you said, end of December, probably they're going to try to have it done by Christmas Eve.
Paul, thanks for spending time with us, and look forward to having you back on.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Paul Mitchell heads Redistricting Partners, getting us up to speed on the redistricting process taking shape across California. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. California State Auditor Elaine Howell is retiring after 21 years of highlighting mismanagement and bad practices with a fine-tooth comb. From cities and counties on the brink of financial calamity to billions in unemployment fraud within the EDD, inefficient pandemic emergency spending, not to mention falling short on promises for affordable housing and reducing homelessness, Howell's tenure as state auditor underscores the importance of the state agency as a crucial independent government watchdog. Here to take a look back at her legacy and really what's at stake as we await a successor is Dan Walters, a political columnist with CalMatters, with the tenure himself, covering California politics since Governor Jerry Brown's first go-around in 1975. Dan, nice to have you with us. You're muted. Oh, unmuted. Hey, Dan.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Dan, how did Elaine Howell come to be the state auditor?
Well, she just was there when they needed a new auditor, and she's, you know, they picked her for the job. I mean, she was a natural choice at the time. And I think anybody who's been around the Capitol, even if they've been on the receiving end of some of her criticism, would have to acknowledge that she's done a bang up job over the last 21 years. It's not an easy job. In fact, one of her jobs, to allude to your just previous guest, Paul Mitchell, one of her jobs is to run the selection project process for the Independent Redistricting Commission. that's how broad her franchise is. And she did that in a very vigorous sort of way over the last two cycles of redistricting.
What stands out to you about her leadership over the last 21 years?
I'm sorry, say that again.
What stands out to you about her leadership over the last 21 years?
Well, what stands out for me is she doesn't mince words. She's a very plain spoken woman who, when she comes to a conclusion, she states it. Some of the stuff she reports on is highly technical. She puts that in plain language and leaves no doubt as to what her conclusion is about the problem at hand. And I think that's a refreshing thing in a political capital, because the politics tends to be driven by obfuscation and spinning and all this kind of stuff. She doesn't spin. She doesn't hide it. She just lays it right out there in plain language. And I think that's a very, very valuable thing, because she deals with things that are very difficult to understand in many cases, but she makes them understandable.
Yeah. I mean, there's really a real weight behind when we say watchdog and independent agency, especially in the realm of talking about the state legislature. Can you just remind us about the importance of the state auditor as an agency in the state?
Yeah, a state auditor delves into specific issues, generally speaking. They do some other things as well, but delves into specific issues that seem to need attention. Now, it's a kind of an odd process by how those issues are defined. She only goes into issues that are handed to her by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, which is a committee of legislators from both houses of the legislature. Legislators make requests of that agency to have her look into a specific issue, and that committee then decides whether she does it or doesn't do it. And if there is a weak point in the auditor process, that is it, because there. On occasion, what you can see politics at hand in choosing what subjects are delved into and which are not. For example, there was a real reluctance to look into the EDD scandal for a long time until it just became too big to ignore, because it would have embarrassed the governor. And the members of the committee that assigned those topics were clearly unwilling to do so for a long time. So there's a weakness in that process. Nobody questions that she does a good job when the issue is assigned to her, but the question of what is going to be assigned to her is still a somewhat political decision.
I mean, when I think about my very short time covering the Capitol is the DMV and wanting to audit the DMV, but that ultimately didn't go forward.
Yeah, the DMV, it was very obvious in the DMV case that the legislature was trying to protect the governor. That actually, I think it was during the Jerry Brown administration. He basically was telling, I'll fix it. You don't need to have an audit. But it became too big to ignore eventually.
Well, aside from testifying at the state legislature, which really is refreshing when you're covering committee hearings, Elaine Howell's work really is behind the scenes and in lengthy audits and responses, and they really speak for themselves. Have you actually interviewed her in the past, and how have those interactions been, if you have?
I have not interviewed her in any formal way. I think we've had a few conversations over the years, but I haven't felt it to be necessary. I mean, you read one of her reports, it's all out there. It doesn't usually require any further explanation. She lays it all out in excruciating detail if you want to read the reports. So like I say, I think I've had a few casual conversations with her during committee, you know, before or after committee meetings sometimes. But basically, I haven't had any long interviews with her. I do know people who work for her, however, and they are unstinting in their praise for her and what a great job it is and how proud they are to work in an office that is free of political taint.
Were you surprised about the announcement to retire?
No. I mean, 21 years is a long time. It was probably time for her to retire. Sometimes I think it's time for me to retire. And there are people who have told me many times, it's time for you to retire. But no, I wasn't surprised. I mean, I think that 21 years is in government, that's an eternity. And I think, but it's good because there's a fairly low turnover in the office and you do have long stints of auditors. And I say the same is true, by the way, of the legislative analyst office, the same sort of thing. Having long tenure at the head of the office ensures continuity. And that's a valuable commodity in politics, because in politics, generally long-term is the next election. But having people in long-term civil servants in long-term positions being watchdogs is very, very valuable. And it's very important that when her replacement is named, or when the replacement for the legislative analyst is named, that the legislature swallows itself and says, okay, we've got to continue on this policy of independence and not just appoint some sort of political hack to the job.
Right. And when we're talking about that process of the search for a new state auditor, I mean, are you concerned that independent watchdog role is ultimately at risk?
I don't think it's at risk particularly. I wrote a column about it recently saying how important it is that it not be at risk. No, I don't think it's so. I think the tradition of the office is pretty well established now, and that were the legislature and the governor to violate that and put some sort of a hack in, there would be hell to pay. I mean, the media and everybody else who depends on that independence of the office would raise a big stink about it, and I don't think they wanted to run that risk. So I don't have any great fear that there's going to be a takeover, if you will, by the politicians. I'm reasonably certain that they're not going to do something as stupid as that.
Dan, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Dan Walters is a political columnist with Cal Matters, discussing State Auditor Elaine Howell's retirement and the importance of this watchdog agency remaining independent as we await to see who will take her place. Still ahead, on the anniversary or the 3 years marking the campfire, a new book follows the Paradise High Bobcats through a remarkable season. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When the campfire ignited 3 years ago this morning, the town of Paradise changed forever, as did the surrounding communities like Megalia, Polga, and Concow. But although Paradise became just a sliver of the 20,000 neighbors that called this place home, the town's heart persevered beyond being known as the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in state history. An anchor of that heart is in one rare structure that survived the campfire, Paradise High School. The Bobcats returned to class, and the football team carried the town as they healed and rebuilt from the unprecedented. I was there for the first day of school. I was also there for the first game, and I witnessed firsthand what drew people to really fall in love with Paradise. It was powerful. But Bill Plaschke continued on. The LA Times columnist followed the Paradise Bobcats through just a remarkable season that really transcends sports, culminating into a new book, Paradise Found, a high school football team's rise from the ashes. Bill joins us now. Welcome to Insight and congratulations on the new book.
Thanks. I'm honored. And it's great. We're doing this on the third anniversary of the fire. I mean, what is that? That was such a horrible, horrible day. And the football team really helped in the resurrection from that day.
Yeah, it really did. You've been with the LA Times since 1996. What stood out to you about the campfire and particularly the Paradise High Bobcat football team?
Well, I was told about 2 months after the campfire, I got a tip that they're going to try to play football the next year. And I didn't see how they could do that because they didn't even know if they're going to be going back to school or not, whether the school would be open. So I flew up there and I met with Rick Prinz, the coach of the football team. And he said, they're in a warehouse at the Chico Airport as a temporary school facility. And he said, yeah, he said, we're going to try to do this. They had 106 kids on the team before the fire. They were down to 22 kids. Every kid lost their home. And every player lost a home. All but one coach has lost their home. So he said, they're going to try to do this. I don't know if it's going to work or not. So I was there for their first practice in the spring. And they're on this vacant lot, glass-strewn, rock-covered, dirty vacant lot with trash everywhere. They're all in wearing hand-me-down clothes from thrift stores because they lost all their clothes. So they get out there, 22 kids, and they're going to have the first practice to start preparing for the 2019 season. And they realize something. Coach says, anybody have a football? They didn't even have a football. All their equipment had burned. All their uniforms had burned. Their helmets had burned. The socks, the cleats, the footballs had burned. So this is a team starting without even a football. That's what drew me to the story. And that's what I wrote a series for the LA Times that became the book, that led to the book, because I just couldn't believe that all these kids were going through. I mean, they're sleeping on floors, sleeping in cars, you know, homeless, couch surfing, living 2 hours from school because they had no, you know, they're again, every Paradise was decimated. They had nothing, yet they had each other.
Yeah.
And they had the team and they had the fabric. And this was the power of sports to transcend the human condition and bond us and inspire us. And they, you know, these kids, they would tell me, they just want a sense of normal, and football was normal to them. And they want, and several kids said, we can't rebuild the town. We don't know construction work. We can't do pipe fitting or plumbing or electricity, but we can play football and maybe bring some people back and make people smile again. So it was a credible season under these terrible conditions.
And an undefeated season at that. I'm curious, when you first began traveling to Paradise, I mean, you understood, you saw and read about the campfire, but did it feel different taking it in with your own eyes?
Yes, and I'm sure you were blown away by this too, Vicky.
It was
unbelievable. You get there and there's nothing there. So everybody said, well, this is like small town football. And I said, no, this is small town football without the town. And they said, well, this is like Friday Night Lights. Was Friday Night Lights without the lights? I mean, it was there was nothing there. There's smoking wreckage. They were practicing down the street from smoking wreckage, from vacant lots with just fireplaces in them. It stunned me, devastation of the city. It stunned me the comeback. And you were at that first game and you saw 5,000 people came from nowhere. I mean, they showed up from everywhere and nowhere, crying and hugging and coming back to the town. And they really, these people needed something to cling on to believe there would be a future for their city. And the football, the Bobcats, in an amazing season, gave that to them.
Yeah. I mean, in that moment of that first game, it really kind of just hit. Yeah, it reminded you or kind of hit home the feeling of home and community. It was just so palpable and just electrifying. It was such a moving and powerful moment to be a part of or just to even witness. I'm curious, since you followed the football team in a very intimate way, what did you learn as a journalist following this football team?
I learned that the human spirit has no, it just overcomes. I learned that kids, the resiliency of young men and women in the face of incredible odds. I mean, these kids, they would get up in the morning. They had a coach that drove around and picked them up and brought them to school because they had no cars. They're living with relatives. They're living by themselves. They would get their school at 8 o'clock. They would go to school all day. They would do their homework on the sidelines during practice. They would practice all night. And then at the end of the day, there was no home for them to go to a lot of times. So they'd hang out in the parking lot all night. It was, and I learned that these kids, though, they kept playing for, they kept putting on the pads, putting on the helmets, going out there. I learned that the human spirit can absorb almost anything. And this fight and the fight and ferocity of these children, the children are the strongest among us. And then one of the kids, I remember after one of the games, you're right, their season was undefeated. After one of the games, I said, is this like a dream? And the kid said, no, a dream would be for me to leave here, this field here, and go to my home, which is no longer there.
Yeah, and I think that just also hits home that the trauma of that wildfire, it was the deadliest wildfire in state history. And when you're talking about the football coach picking up students, I mean, I followed students that, you know, they get dropped off at the Home Depot and they would have to bus in because there yes. weren't homes for people to live. But going to practice and going actually back to school, which was one of the few buildings still standing, I think that really helped not only these children, really, and these teenagers, but really the whole community heal.
Yeah, I think they wanted that. It gave them that stability. I mean, you saw, so after every game now, in the old days, they would just celebrate on the field after they won a game, and they, you know, the players would get together with their parents. Now, the entire town would come out of the stands and on into the end zone, and everybody would gather around. So after every game, the town left the stands and came to the dawn of the field to share in this is who we are. We're still standing. Everything else is burned down, but through this little high school football team, we're still standing. And yes, I think the PTSD suffered by these children everybody in the town is enormous. The book is filled with stories, and you've covered this very closely, I know, of the escapes from the fire. Everyone's got an escape story. Every one of these kids had to drive through burning flames, down the mountain, you know, cars on fire, pulling off the road, running for their lives. The coach had to push his truck down the hill because they ran out of gas. I mean, they're so full of these stories, and he had to deal with all this while playing football. Yet again, they proved that the human spirit is stronger than anything.
Yeah, today, given that it marks 3 years since the campfire, a lot has happened in that time. I mean, you have COVID and the pandemic, which really disrupted schools and disrupted sports. Did you keep in touch with the football team during this time? And if so, how did they fare? How were they doing?
Yeah, not great. You know, COVID wiped it. COVID on top of this. So they lost the whole year with the fire. Then they lost the whole year and a half with COVID. It was really tough. And so the fans there aren't as many fans as there were anymore. And some of these kids straight away from school and straight into the wrong areas and things like that. So it's been tough. I like to say it's a happily ever after story, but you've been up there, Vicky. It's slow going. I was just up there about a month ago, and the town is still a long way from being back. And this will be a long journey. And this book is just really the first step in a long journey.
Yeah. When you go up to Paradise, I mean, there's just still leveled lots. I mean, the debris has been removed. But when you're talking about a community of really 20,000 people, which is very sizable for a rural community, which is about 30 minutes outside Chico, I mean, the fact that 3 years later is just sobering that it hasn't been completely rebuilt as you would hope, or as we would all hope?
2,000 people are live there, I think now, 2,000 or 3,000 people. There. That's, yes, it's, in fact, so the coach and I met for a PR thing for the book, and it was a night, and so we're going to go get dinner. It was 6 or 7 o'clock. There's no place open except Taco Bell. And even then, the lobby wasn't open. It's just, it shuts down. It's dark. It's cold. You know, it's so beautiful. Vicky, you just saw how beautiful it is up there. So you would hope it really comes back. And I hope the football team, for if only for this brief moment, really helped make people believe again. And I hope they keep believing.
Yeah. Bill, thanks for joining us. And thank you for putting together this book and following the Paradise High Bobcats.
Thanks. I'm honored. It is my honor to spotlight these kids. I hope they have this book. They can tell their grandkids, kids and grandkids, what they went through. And I hope that if that's all it serves, then I've done a good job. Thank you.
Bill Plaschke is an LA Times columnist and author of the new book, Paradise Found, A High School Football Team's Rise from the Ashes, following the Paradise High Bobcats through just a remarkable undefeated season following the campfire. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Pauline Bartoloni, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Muniz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.